It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When someone suffers from a neurological disorder, time and accessibility can be of the essence for evaluation and treatment. The standard diagnostic procedure is an electroencephalogram to detect abnormalities in brain waves. Neurologist Dr. Kevin Kelly is a researcher with Allegheny Health Network, and he's received a grant to assess the effectiveness with a new device called BrainView to evaluate the electrical activity in our brains. Dr. Kelly, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you.
How common are EEGs? For instance, how many are performed at maybe Allegheny General Hospital?
So currently we perform throughout the whole hospital about 2,400 a year.
So what are they used for? What are they used to diagnose and then lead toward treatment?
Well, fundamentally, the study is used to diagnose epileptic disorders, but also, too, there are a lot of other type of spells that patients may have that are not epileptic in nature. So the EEG can give a lot of information, and coupled with video recordings can give basically diagnostic information about whether something is actually epileptic in nature or not.
Are they used for head injuries?
They are, because many of the head injuries that are moderate to severe can be associated with the development of post-traumatic epilepsy. For that indication, EEG can again be diagnostic.
The device that someone might encounter in a hospital setting puts electrodes directly onto the patient's head, What's needed for an EEG in terms of other equipment and even the professionals to operate it?
Well, typically you have a trained EEG technologist who is the person who puts on the electrodes, and that is somewhat of a time-consuming process. And that's for every patient, whether they're being done in the clinical neurophysiology lab as an outpatient or in the epilepsy monitored unit where people are brought in for extended periods of time, or even a bedside evaluation, medical surgical floor, or in an ICU. So the technologist is critical for setting up the EEG.
Can it be costly?
It is costly. It's a procedure that has a professional fee in terms of the person reading the EEG, interpreting it, but also, too, the technical fee, and that's really typically hospital-based.
So let's talk about the device that you're researching, BrainView. What's it look like?
It's tiny. It's miniaturized and meant to be so. And the idea about it is that the portability is just really an advantage of it. So we're able to take the whole device in a tiny suitcase with connecting cables. And that, with a newly designed head cap, have the EEG hooked up to the electrodes in the head cap very quickly, easily, and start a recording.
I've seen images almost like a swimming cap.
It's pretty much what it looks like. It looks like a swim cap. It has a chin strap, which basically tugs down on the head cap and the electrodes that are embedded. And the position of the electrodes are no different than the standard, 1020 international system of recording. So it's basically a full electrode array for the recordings that can be done in basically any setting by anyone.
Is the time frame comparable to an EEG? Can it be done more quickly? What?
It can be done more quickly. So part of what we're testing in this NIH-funded grant is the time that it takes a novice to actually put on the electrodes and to begin recording. So what we say, based on preliminary testing, is that it can be done quickly.
Hold it. You said a novice compared to—so who can operate this?
So anybody can operate it. So what we do for the people that are going to be testing this in the grant is we give them a two-minute video just to show how it's done. We give them an instructional card, and then after they read through it, if they have no questions, we start the stopwatch and basically time how long it takes them to put on the head cap and begin the recording.
Is this meant to just see how easy it can be used? I mean, why would somebody like me want to know or need to know how to use this? It's still going to be used in a hospital setting, is it not?
It is. Our preliminary testing has just really indicated that there is a remarkable ease of use. It's just easy to do. It's fast to do. But the purpose of the grant is really a performance validation study, meaning that, well, this is what we say is so easy about it and easy to do. This is now the testing of it. So for that reason, we want to be able to demonstrate with data that, in fact, what we say can be demonstrated by people who have very little familiarity. And the applicability of this is that in remote locations, people who are not really familiar with neurological problems, certainly not with EEG technology, they're able to watch a little video, read a card, and be able to run the EEG as expertly as basically anybody can. We think that it potentially is that good.
Would smaller facilities be able to afford this device?
Yes. So this is really meant to be priced for market competitiveness, and this would be much, much less expensive than what the standard workstations are for typical in-house EEG recording.
And the fact that, in a sense, you don't have to have a specialist do it, does that also help with the cost, overall cost factor?
Right. So really, you're not going to be involving a technical fee, which is part of the cost of any study. So in a different setting, in a clinic, it would be 5 to 10 minutes of some worker's time, which really would not be an added cost in that setting.
What about comfort? Is the comfort level any different for the patient?
Yeah, it's a very comfortable cap. So for one thing. So that's one of the easy things, too. Plus, there really is no conductive paste or gel that's put on the scalp. It's just a saline-based electrode system. So after the cap is removed, there's basically little to no cleanup of the scalp, which is not the case for standard recordings. After standard recordings, you have to get the goo out of your hair.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Dr. Kevin Kelly, a neurologist with the Allegheny Health Network, who's conducting a study on the new device, BrainView, to measure brain activity in times of distress. So how are you measuring BrainView versus the standard EEG?
So the way we've set up the trial is that for any patient that comes in who has had an EEG ordered for clinical purposes, what we will do is we will recruit that person to see if they would be willing to enroll in this study. So what we will do is we will do back-to-back, really tandem recordings, first with BrainView, which is only going to take about 15 minutes of actual recording time, after which they then proceed to get the clinical study. So we will have two studies done at the same time with essentially the same type of requests that the patient is asked in terms of opening and closing eyes, things like that, so that the tests are comparable.
How many patients in phase one here?
So we're going to be doing 76 patients. So 38 of them are going to be done by novices who have never done anything with regard to EEG. And then the last 38, for statistical purposes, are going to be run by the clinical coordinator for the study.
Allegheny General, major urban hospital. You've got all the equipment you need for EEGs. But who might benefit from BrainView? Smaller hospitals? What?
Smaller hospitals, remote settings, clinics that really don't have access to this, or it may be in areas where patients have to travel significant distances to get an EEG done. But we also see it in terms of even in our own emergency department. Is there an application there? Because if you wanted to have a spot EEG in the middle of the night, sometimes it's not so easy to get the technologist to come in because she's involved with other studies within the hospital. And certainly, too, even an application in concussion clinics where people are coming in after a brain injury, to be able to assess them this way. So rather than just simply relying on structural brain imaging, CT, sometimes MRI, that we can do a functional test that is, again, accessible, easy to use, and right there.
Accessibility, if we're talking about a smaller facility, a rural facility, is the key getting the diagnosis sooner so that the treatment can start sooner rather than waiting to get to an urban hospital to go through the whole procedure?
Yeah, exactly right. So that as well as referral to the appropriate specialist, but to have real-time data that's transferred to experts who can read the EEG and then to have a diagnosis and to refer appropriately.
Are you confident that BrainView can be used to detect brain activity in sort of all sorts of scenarios that an EEG is used for?
this is going to be a limited study in that it's only going to be 15 minutes in an outpatient setting. So this is a first step, and the mechanism that we've been lucky enough to be awarded by NIH is a small business innovative research grant. So this is considered to be a phase one study. It's a one-year study, so this is just the first important but still baby step. So this type of testing is not going to indicate necessarily broad applicability, but we think that there will be enough information from the data to extend that to different recording venues.
How long will phase one last?
It'll last 1 year.
Mm-hmm. So what are your hopes, your plans beyond phase one? What do you really want to do? What do you want to learn and then move forward with?
What we want to learn is to validate that what we say is in fact true, that this is easy to use, it's quick, it has high fidelity in terms of the recording signals, and that we're able to discriminate normal patterns from abnormal patterns. So if we're able to demonstrate that, then we think that a multi-site study involving different venues, and by that I mean, can it be done in an ICU? Can it be done in an epilepsy monitoring unit, in an emergency department, in a concussion clinic? We feel that there is actually broad applicability, but that has to be also tested and validated. So this is just really step one. It's a phase one study.
So the broader applicability, that's also something you want to learn.
Very much so.
Eventually.
Very much so. So as soon as the preliminary data comes in from this year's study, we'll begin to write the phase two study as well.
What excites you about this device, even just exploring the possibilities of it?
I think just greater access to more people who need it. And for those people who are disadvantaged by location, by resources, I think that this is a technology that can bring a diagnostic value to people that otherwise is either not obtained or, in many cases, just delayed without really significantly good reasons.
Neurologist Dr. Kevin Kelly from Allegheny Health Network is researching the effectiveness of BrainView, a new, more accessible device to detect neurological disorders. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Very nice speaking with you today.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. The federal government wants to resume capital punishment. So what does that mean for the gunman accused of killing 11 people last year at the Tree of Life synagogue? And PennDOT says Pennsylvanians will soon be able to select a third gender option on their driver's license or ID for those who don't identify as male or female, joining 10 other states that have rolled out similar plans. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Pittsburgh Steelers and Philadelphia Eagles football teams merge in 1943. Both teams had lost so many players to military service during World War II that they had trouble finding their individual teams, creating the Phil Pitt Combine, more commonly known as the Steagles. During World War II, more than 600 young NFL players joined the armed forces. Government officials had talked about the importance of sports as entertainment and morale for citizens, so the football leagues of the day did their best to continue to play. Most of the Steagles players were deferred from the draft, leaving them available. The team ended their season 5-4-1. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Joyce Megerson Moore of Stanton Heights has led New Horizon Theater for more than two decades as chair of its board of directors, while also filling several other roles, such as company cook and chauffeur. Megerson Moore spoke with 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort about the value of community theater.
Elva Branson, who actually founded New Horizon Theater, Inc., asked me if I would volunteer to help with the reception for the new play. And I agreed to do that. And I've been there ever since, and that's been 27 years. But I didn't take an active leadership role until she left.
So what keeps you going? What's your motivation?
What keeps me motivated, I guess, are the different plays that we do, the audiences that we have, and all the plays are different. We have comedies, we have drama, we have musicals. And so the process, I think, is what's really important to me, and it's It's fulfilling, too.
What kind of plays are you trying to present that you think will benefit the community?
One of the ones we do at the beginning of the season we started doing is like a historical piece. We did The Ballad of Emmett Till, and you remember that horrible story about Emmett Till, a 14-year-old young man who was lynched down in Mississippi. We did it, Josh, the Black Babe Ruth, by Josh Gibson. We've done Detroit 67, about the riots or civil rebellion in Detroit in the 60s. Mm-hmm. So those are kinds of plays that we believe people need to see, particularly our young people.
You are Dr. Joyce Megerson Moore, PhD in counseling education. So what has been more fulfilling for you, your professional career or your volunteer work in the theater?
I'm going to say equally important, because some of the people I worked with before I started doing this, and I was been doing this all the time too while I was, you know, doing my job in community mental health. You know, that was fulfilling too, working with our clients. And I was an administrator, and so being an administrator there has helped with this work, as well as this work helped there too. We always call ourselves the Theater with Heart, because we know the people who come in, and sometimes we drive them home when their ride hasn't come. We also, because we pay our cast and our crew, not what I'd like to pay them, so we try to make up in other ways. You know, we have this opening night reception where we have this excellent food and everybody gets to meet the people from the outside. And then at the end, we have this cast party with all kinds of food, homemade food, I might add.
And so you're the cook too.
I'm the cook too, and my husband's the cook. So we try to make up in other little ways. We know that food doesn't pay you off, but at least we try to show them that we really appreciate the work that they do.
Joyce Megerson Moore, thank you for taking time to talk to me today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A former Pittsburgh area country club that's been closed for several years is reverting back to nature. 90.5 WESA's Rachel Gobep reports that a local nonprofit wants to protect the space for the community to enjoy.
Renee Dolney and her dog Paris trot along the asphalt at the former Churchill Valley Country Club. It's a warm summer afternoon, and Paris is familiar with this route. His ears are perked, and his tail wags like a flag whipping in the wind. Dolney is from Blackridge, within walking distance of the property, and says she fell in love with it about a year ago.
It's profoundly changed my relationship to nature. I used to think nature was like something that was like, I have to get on the turnpike, go to like a state park, and it's not. It can be right here in your backyard.
Paris laps up water from the nearby Chalfont Run, which flows through the middle of the country club. But golfers don't tee off on the green anymore. The club closed in 2013. Instead, locals are beginning to explore the space.
This place is already kind of a de facto community park, and one of the things I love about it is I met so many of my neighbors that I wouldn't have seen.
Now, a local land conservation nonprofit wants to make the 148-acre property in Churchill and Penn Hills a permanent green space. The Allegheny Land Trust is under contract to purchase the grounds. That means the site could be managed as an area for recreation, such as hiking, running, and bird watching. About 95,000 people live within a 3-mile radius of the property located off of Beulah Road. The Land Trust's Tom Dougherty says one of the many things that makes the site special are the 3 miles of paved trails, which are left over from when it was a golf course.
So when you have a paved trail like this, all of a sudden, this type of green space and this type of nature becomes accessible to older people who aren't as agile on rough terrain.
It's also convenient for families with strollers, people with disabilities, and those looking for a workout. Plus, it saves the nonprofit a lot of money because they don't have to pour the concrete. Grass and weeds stand higher than Dougherty's knees, and the property is covered in a mix of woodlands and meadows. He says they'd make subtle changes to the green space going forward, but it would look similar to how it does today.
We would make minor improvements, such as the parking area and signage and other things, to make sure that the property looks good and is safe.
He says they plan to maintain the site, but won't build recreational facilities. Dougherty says green spaces need to be protected because they sequester rainfall, which helps to prevent landslides and flooding. Recent bouts of heavy rain have hit Allegheny County, making it the wettest year on record.
The way we treat our green space, our remaining green space in Allegheny County, has a lot to influence on whether we mitigate those problems going forward or whether we exacerbate those problems.
But the land trust is still trying to make the protection of this site a reality. It needs to secure $3 million. The land trust currently has $2 million in grant requests with state agencies and launched a campaign for community members to raise $100,000 by the end of this year.
Not only does that community campaign help us close the funding gap, but maybe equally important is it demonstrates local support.
The land trust estimates that Churchill currently has 31 acres of protected natural green space, which is in Bullock Penns Park, while Penn Hills has 48 acres. The new addition would bring the total to more than 200 acres between the communities. That's exciting for incoming land trust board member Ted Weller. It'll give him the opportunity to do one of his favorite things, bird watching.
Just in the 15 or 20 minutes we've been walking, in the heat of the day when normally it's the quietest, I've heard at least 15 different types of birds.
Green spaces promote biodiversity, which gives people like Weller more chances to birdwatch. As nature continues to reclaim what was once hers at the former country club, Weller says he expects to hear more birds singing. I'm Rachel Gobep, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There have been several interesting legal developments in recent days that could have implications across the nation, and especially in Pennsylvania. We're going to sort them out with WESA's legal analyst, David Harris. He's a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. He's host of the podcast, Criminal Injustice. Hello, David.
Great to be with you, Kevin.
U.S. Attorney General William Barr has ordered the Federal Bureau of Prisons to resume executing death row inmates after 16 years. David, remind us why there had been a halt on these federal executions.
The federal executions were halted because there was insufficient evidence of having a protocol for execution through lethal injection that would meet federal constitutional standards. And this has been a problem in a lot of states that use the death penalty as well. There is now a protocol in place, ordered by the Attorney General, for a lethal injection death that is used in several of the states that has been approved. It is a single drug, and the lack of a drug is why it stopped, and now it will be resumed.
The means of lethal injection that had been used that were stopped, was that cruel and unusual punishment? Is that, how it was found?
Yes, that was the basic argument. There's also been trouble with getting a drug cocktail that would pass constitutional muster because a number of the companies that made these drugs were in Europe and they were refusing to sell them for execution purposes in the United States.
Because the countries where they're located don't have the death penalty?
They not only don't have it, they're against it. The European Union bans it. So it became very, very difficult to find lethal injection drugs to carry it out.
One other thing the U.S. Attorney General ordered was that the executions be set up for five individuals who have exhausted all their appeals. Can we expect more to come now that Mr. Barr has made this decision?
Oh, I think there's every reason to expect that. He selected five particularly heinous cases. I don't think that was an accident. All of these executions have been on the books for some time with just no order to carry them out.
David, Pittsburgh has one person facing federal charges right now. If Robert Bowers is convicted, the alleged shooter who killed 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue last year, he could qualify for the death penalty, correct?
Absolutely. He would qualify based on the statutory criteria that are in the law, but there is a further decision-making process. It will sort of depend in large part on what happens here on the ground in Pittsburgh with our U.S. Attorney's Office, and they make the initial decision, and then it's carried up the chain.
Even if he is convicted, any possible execution would be probably years away because of the appeal process?
Yes, that's likely. It also depends on the circumstances of the conviction, because we did hear some whispers not long ago here in Pittsburgh that there might be a plea deal in the works that might essentially take the death penalty out of the case for a plea of guilty to all the top charges.
David, a district judge in Erie County is suspected of having wrongly charged nearly 900 people during a three-year period. Judge Brenda Nichols is now under fire from Auditor General Eugene DePasquale. Catch us up on what Judge Nichols is accused of doing.
Well, Judge Nichols is no longer on the bench. She was defeated in her bid for a third six-year term as a district judge. What she did was to take what are customarily debts that are handled in civil court. If I owe you money and I refuse to pay, you can sue me. Everybody knows that. It's done all the time. What she was doing was, instead of having these complaints filed in civil court, she was essentially charging them as criminal matters. And that is a way to assist the person or business that holds the debt by saving them the civil court filing fee. But at the same time, you stand to increase the pressure on the person who's in debt to pay up. Essentially, it's debtor's prison.
According to the Auditor General, some of the amounts owed were as little as $7 for a school lunch account.
Yes.
And overdue library book fees.
Yeah, just ridiculous stuff. District courts in Pennsylvania are set up so the judges don't have to be lawyers. And this judge was not a lawyer. They take 30 days of training. Now, some judges who are not lawyers but take that training, they can do a fine job. And some judges in this office who are lawyers might not do a great job. But you'd hope that somebody somewhere would realize that taking people to criminal court over a $7 library fine, that there was something wrong with that.
Do we know if she benefited?
There is nothing in the record that I've seen that indicates that she benefited. It did save the people holding the debts those filing fees, and that shortchanged the state by some $20,000+. But that's really the smallest part of the damage here. You have people ending up with criminal records, and they didn't even know it.
What's the implication of that? That can affect you in job searching? And
absolutely.
Other...
It can. And the way that this all came to light, in fact, was somebody getting a job or applying for a job, and the employer found a criminal record, and the person wasn't even aware of it. This can really damage people's lives and careers.
Do they have any recourse?
Well, in order to erase, essentially, a criminal conviction, you have one of two ways of doing it. You got to go back to court and say that this was wrong. And that's going to be hard to do without legal representation and so forth. Or in certain limited circumstances, you can get your record expunged. If it was me, I would want to go back to court and have this taken off the record, have it reversed and cleaned up. But this isn't an easy process, and it's an individual process usually. But this is really uncharted territory. The judge could be disciplined as a judge if she were still a judge, and could be disciplined as a lawyer if she were a lawyer. She's neither anymore.
So, any repercussions for her?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, she's really beyond the reach of the system unless there's some evidence that she herself committed some kind of a crime or benefited in some way, and I know of no evidence of that.
Our guest on The Confluence is WESA's legal analyst, David Harris. David, the state attorney general is trying to convince firearm dealers and police precincts to do a more effective job tracking guns. Aren't police departments required to enter information about the guns used in a crime into a state database already?
Yes, there is such a requirement. Up to this point, they've been able to do it by putting it in the database electronically or sending it to the state attorney general's office in regular mail. And there's a huge backlog of these paper pieces of information. What the attorney general is proposing is that everybody in the state do this, every law enforcement agency, and there's been spotty compliance up to this point, as far as I know, including the attorney general's office itself. So he wants to get everybody doing it. And then number two, he wants to get everybody doing it electronically so it will be much faster. Both of these are good ideas because, you know, we have problems in this country, but it's not the vast majority of gun owners that cause problems with criminal violence. It's a certain small number of people who are using guns, usually stolen guns or illegal guns or guns that they cannot legally possess, in violent crimes. So to track where those guns come from gives law enforcement the tools it needs to prevent these kind of things from happening going forward.
In his press conference, Shapiro was surrounded by law enforcement and gun control advocates. Are you hearing any pushback to Shapiro's track and trace campaign?
I am not yet. I wouldn't be surprised, of course. There's always controversy over any kind of gun effort. But it's important to understand there's a difference between the traditional ideas of gun control and ideas that are targeted at criminal violence with guns. Those are two different problems, and we often mix them up.
Pennsylvania Department of Corrections has been trying to reduce the prison population by getting more inmates out on parole. That policy has come under fire after it was learned that five former state prisoners allegedly committed six murders since May. What's going to happen now? Is the parole policy going to come under more scrutiny?
Well, it will come under more scrutiny, and it should. I think if this were 10 or 15 years ago, you would simply have whoever was in charge shut the parole process down and parole as few people as possible at the highest risk categories. What we see instead is a more thoughtful response from Secretary of Corrections John Wetzel, who has served both in the Corbett administration and in the current Wolf administration. And what he's done is he said, okay, let's look at the data. And he's already got data out there he's made public that indicates that the levels of arrests of parolees have not changed. The levels of even occurrences of serious crimes is really pretty much what it's been for over 10 years. The problem, of course, is that when you have six or five or four really terrible incidents, everybody wants to make policy based on these tragedies. And they are tragedies. There's no doubt about that. But it's the wrong thing to react to them so quickly.
But it seems like Secretary Wetzel is looking at it as an internal review. The Corrections Officers Union wants an external review. Might that be sort of more reassuring to the public if the review is done from outside?
I think it would be. Anytime you have the question of who guards the guardians, you know, can you really police yourself? It's a legitimate question. We see this all the time with law enforcement. We want to have an independent prosecutor, things like that. Great. And I think Secretary Wetzel might be persuaded at some point to have a university research partner perhaps grab this and look at the data. But an independent view of it wouldn't be bad. It's all going to end up before a committee in the state legislature for review.
One other note. Former Attorney General Kathleen Kane was released from prison Wednesday after serving 8 of her 10 to 23-month prison sentence for perjury and obstruction of justice. Any word on what's next for her?
You know, you got to feel bad for her as a human being, but she did something that the chief law enforcement officer of a state simply cannot do. She violated grand jury secrecy rules, and then she lied about it. When I teach grand jury material to my students, and I emphasize how it's all got to be kept secret, I show that picture of her leaving court with those fine chrome bracelets on. It was a betrayal of our system. I don't know where she's going to end up, but she doesn't belong practicing law anymore.
In fact, she can't, can she?
She's disbarred.
David Harris is a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, as well as WESA's legal analyst, and he's the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. David, thanks so much.
Always a treat, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Transgender, non-binary, and gender non-conforming residents are praising the State Transportation Department's recent announcement to offer a gender-neutral option for Pennsylvania driver's licenses. WESA's Katie Blackley has been reporting on the story. She joins us in studio. Katie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Katie, let's start with people who are a little more familiar probably with what it means to be transgender, but if you would please define gender nonconforming, non-binary.
So these are individuals who don't fall neatly into male or female. They don't identify that way. They can be both, they can be neither, or they can be more than the two. It doesn't necessarily mean, like we said, that they're transgender, but that they fall somewhere along the gender spectrum or that they're fluid and flexible. And it's important to note this is also separate from sexual orientation. Just like transgender people, people who are non-binary or gender non-conforming can have a variety of sexual orientations.
The announcement from PennDOT seemed to come out of the blue. What got PennDOT to do this?
So I did speak with a PennDOT spokesperson, and she said the agency had heard from people who just wanted this as an option. It's available at like 12 or 13 other states currently. You can have an X. That's what this is. It's instead of an M or an F, it's an X, which indicates other, not male or female. And I also spoke with the PennDOT person who said it's part of like the state's move to just be more inclusive in general.
What about other states?
So they have an option, like I said, to identify as an X instead of the M or the F. It's like a checkbox for most things.
Do many states have that option?
Yeah, it's about a dozen or more. It's actually adding like almost every week now.
For your reporting, you spoke with people who will be affected by the policy. Why is it so important?
Yeah, I did speak with a number of people who identify either as transgender, non-binary, gender fluid, gender non-conforming. And they said, you know, this might be appear to be a small thing. It's just another little letter on your ID. But a lot of these people aren't properly identified. They can't be who they are in a lot of these public spaces, whether it's their family or their employer, they don't use the proper pronouns. So for the state to be like, yeah, we recognize you, we see your non-binary, your other than non-binary status, that's really important. So two of these people, with Hank and Brogan, you're going to hear Hank first and then Brogan.
And it's not like anyone's doing it for kicks. You know, it's, I think, trusting people to know themselves and to opt in if it's what's right for them, without the barriers of courts or doctors, I think is one of the more important things.
The simplicity of having your driver's license and, you know, having a gender marker on that driver's license. And then if you were ever to be asked for that driver's license and for somebody to have, you know, the authority to look at that driver's license and then identify your gender marker as not aligning with your presentation, that puts somebody in a risky position.
So what Hank brings up is the idea of removing barriers to getting this change. So when you get your gender changed on a license, typically when you are transgender, for example, you have to get a letter from a physician saying you are living as this gender now. You have transitioned or you're in the process of transitioning. And so what Hank was saying is they hope that you don't have that barrier necessarily because a lot of these people aren't transitioning. And then Brogan was mentioning, that it's important to have this because it's a safety issue for a lot of people. If you don't present, If you present as other than what your ID says, it can be an issue if you're pulled over and they're like, oh, you don't match this. What's going on? So having that X really makes it more comfortable for people who don't conform to the two binaries.
Very briefly, will this affect the federally required Real ID rollout in Pennsylvania?
PennDOT says no. The Real ID is like a federal thing, and the Real ID administrators are letting the states determine how gender is used in IDs. So PennDOT says, nope, this probably won't affect them.
And a timeline?
PennDOT says within the next year. So it's August now, and they hope to have it done by July, but hopefully sooner. I spoke with a couple people who said they're going to check in every few months, so I'll keep you updated.
WESA reporter Katie Blackley, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, what should be the priorities when the legislature returns to session? Election reform? Investment in infrastructure? A conversation with House Majority Leader Brian Cutler. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovic, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.